10:06.
And good morning. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio, and online at kpcc.org. I'm Ted Chen from NBC4, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle this morning. And I hope you're having a great morning. Trying to calm jitters about the economy, President Bush today said that the country is obviously going through a tough time with regards to the economy, but he expressed confidence about an economic rebound, and he did so in a speech to the Economic Club in New York, in which he said this was not the first time the economy has been rattled, and he said he is certain that it will ride out its troubles, but he acknowledged that these are quote, these are uncertain times. Joining us to talk about this, Neil Irwin, National Economy and Federal Reserve Reporter for The Washington Post, and Rex Nutting, D.C. Bureau Chief for MarketWatch.com. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us this morning.
Morning, Ted.
Good to be here.
Let's talk first about the president's comments. Neil, a bit of an understatement saying, obviously, we're going through a tough time.
You could say that. It's certainly a tough time. This has been the president's approach throughout his administration. He in his view, by not expressing concern or not expressing too much worry or a sense of panic, he can avoid a sense of panic setting in the economy. So it's not terribly surprising that he wasn't stepping up there and saying, it's a crisis. We should all run around with our heads, our hands waving. So, yes, that's a tone of calm from the president today.
How much can a president of the United States really do at this point?
In the short run, it's very tricky. It's very hard. There's not a whole lot he can do. The Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve are doing things to try and address the financial market crisis, including today with Bear Stearns. The Congress has already passed, and the president has signed a stimulus bill that will presumably put money in people's pockets and try and keep the economy from being too soft in the second half of the year. But his options are limited. There's only so much a president can do to control how the economy works out.
Rex, I want to ask you about Bear Stearns. It announced $2.75 billion in write-downs since last year. It lost half its value. Its stock did within the first 30 minutes of the opening of the market today. Let's talk a little bit about Bear Stearns and why this company is having such an impact on the market as a whole. Kind of, if you could kind of give us a 101 on the importance of this particular bank. It's the fifth largest investment bank in the nation.
Well, Bear Stearns was probably the most leveraged bank on Wall Street, which meant that it had more out there in loans than it really had on deposit, and so it was very exposed to the downturn in the housing market, downturn in a lot of these sophisticated securities that are in so much trouble right now. And as more and more institutions get in trouble, they try to sell what they have, or they get a margin call from their lender, and that's essentially what's happened to Bear Stearns. It's essentially a run on the bank, where they just didn't have enough money in their coffers to survive the day, and that's why they had to go to the Federal Reserve and say we need an emergency loan, and that's what happened today. You know, I think the concern, of course, on Wall Street is that Bear Stearns may not be alone. You get one of these banks failing, and that's a tragedy for the people who work there, and it's a problem for the markets. But if you get more than one, if you get several banks, big banks failing, then you really have a real crisis because they can bring each other down. That's the way they're interconnected. And that's the real concern I think Wall Street has, is what's the next shoe or next dozen shoes that are going to drop here? And we're already seeing trading in the options market showing that a lot of people are worried about Lehman Brothers, UBS, and Citibank. And boy, those are three huge, huge banks, and if any of them are getting the same kind of trouble that Bear Stearns is in, the market's got a lot more to worry about.
Neil Irwin, can you explain what the Federal Reserve is actually going to be doing to bail out Bear Stearns and why this is perceived as necessary?
Sure. They would. First of all, I think they would really chafe at the term bailout, though a lot of people are throwing that around today. What they're doing is making available something called the discount window that it's existed for many decades, and a bank that is facing a run on the bank can go to the discount window and put up collateral, whatever loans it has on its books, and trade that illiquid collateral that nobody wants to buy for cash. And so a regular bank can do that.
Can you explain liquid collateral, what that is?
Sure. If it's illiquid, it means that the market isn't functioning right, that it might be a safe government bond, it might be a loan that is perfectly sound, but because of a sense of crisis and fear in the market, nobody wants to buy it, and it's there's no market for it. That's what happens when there's a run on the bank. Banks have money tied up in different people's businesses and homes, and their depositors want their money now, and it gets to be a problem. As Rex says, that's kind of exactly what Bear's facing, although Bear Stearns is not a commercial bank. It's an investment bank, so it can't just go to the regular discount window. Instead, it had to get this special permission and this special deal with J.P. Morgan to essentially do the same thing, to put up some of these assets it has that are viewed as reasonably sound and get cash in exchange so it can settle its debts. And so in the view of the Fed, it's not a bailout. It's making a short-term kind of emergency loan available, but I can certainly understand why many people would characterize it that way.
And you know, I'm sure there are people out there who, when they see these situations, will ask, why should the federal government, why should taxpayer money go to these companies that may be in the situation that they're in, because of their own choices?
Well, the people making these decisions would draw a distinction between things that just involve a private bank failure, and as Rex says, if Bear Stearns goes under, that would hurt the shareholders, and that would hurt the employees of Bear Stearns. But the distinction is between something like that just hurts the shareholders of that institution, and things that would potentially cause a massive crisis that could hurt us all. And that's what the New York Fed did in 1998 with a bailout of a hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management, and there's a very similar thing happening today. Try and prevent a systemic problem from enveloping the financial markets and making it causing just widespread problems.
And how would a collapse of Bear Stearns hurt us all?
Well, potentially, all the banks that do business with Bear Stearns would not have faith that their assets are valuable, and this same run on the bank that's happened with Bear Stearns would happen with, potentially Citigroup or UBS or Lehman Brothers, any number of other financial institutions. And if it's one thing for one institution on Wall Street to go under or have severe problems, it's another thing if all of them do. That could crimp the availability of credit. You might not be able to get a loan, even if you have sound credit, and that's the kind of thing that could just grind the entire economy to a halt, theoretically. And it certainly a lot of people in the government and in the Federal Reserve and in the banks trying to make sure that doesn't happen.
And if the banks make that run on Bear Stearns, and that affects the credit or the people trying to get credit from those banks?
Yes, potentially. If you're a bank and you have a lot of exposure to losses from Bear Stearns, that's money you don't have available to lend out to the guy down the street who wants to take out a loan to buy a house or to buy a car. This very much is connected to the availability of credit and finance throughout the country.
And to what extent can the federal government or the Fed Reserve continue to go into this? I mean, are they put in a position where if this happens to other investment banks that the same window will become available? And would there be a limit or a saturation
point? Well, that's the risk. And the risk is what economists call moral hazard, which is that by taking this action, you've created a situation where everybody takes unnecessary risks because they think there's this pot of money there to bail them out if the risks go wrong. And I can assure you there were some people at the Federal Reserve and throughout the government worrying about that and wondering if that would be the situation in this case.
A historically valid worry.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's no question. It's moral hazard is absolutely an issue. The question is, which is worse? Is it worse to have that risk that people take these unnecessary risks, or is it worse to have, at the worst possible outcome, a meltdown of the entire financial system?
Rex Nutting, with regard to Bear Stearns, how much responsibility does Bear Stearns itself and its board bear, no pun intended, with regard to this, and how much should be distributed among shareholders, among people who hold these portfolios, and perhaps also were complicit in making bad choices with mortgage-backed securities?
Well, Bear Stearns was one of the most aggressive companies in packaging these securities into very, very complicated structures that really are at the, are at the root of this problem. I think that Bear Stearns made a lot of money for its investors, for its shareholders over the last few years by engaging in some very risky behavior. And it's coming home to roost to them now. So I think that they bear a significant responsibility. But you've got to remember that this isn't just happening in isolation. This is a global crisis of liquidity right now where even the best securities, the least risky securities that you could have, people who didn't really engage in any kind of risky behavior are also suffering because they cannot sell their bonds or their securities at anything like the real price, that the price that should be fetched in the market. So the whole system is seizing up, and Bear Stearns is sort of the first body to pop to the surface here. So I think we can say that, you know, the people at Bear probably deserve to go under to some extent because they engage in this process. But for the rest of us, we've got to be wary of what would happen, what the collateral damage to us is if a big company like this is to go under and the whole system would freeze up even more. I think that's the Fed's concern. In a crisis like this, you don't worry who's responsible. You put out the fire first, and then you assign responsibility later.
Neil Irwin, you write in your piece today how this is really just the latest result in kind of the snowball effect we've been experiencing, what you call a series of imbalances that made Americans and the rest of the world feel richer than they were and created the situation that we're now paying the price for.
That's right. There's a tendency to look at all of these things in isolation, that the dollar has been declining in value, that consumer spending is pulling back, that there's very likely a recession happening in the United States right now, that there's these problems in the financial system. Yesterday we had a fund from the Carlyle Group that went into default. We have the news today with Bear Stearns. As tempting as it is to look at all these things in isolation, they really are one story. And they're one story about a series of imbalances in the availability of credit and the and American consumer spending that have built up over many, many years. And it's ugly as these things unwind, but it's not the kind of nice, smooth lines you see in an economics textbook. But that's what's happening. And this is this kind of halting, unpleasant thing where every day we seem to have a new crisis that arises. And it could very well be that way for a while as all these imbalances unwind.
And it's all because we couldn't help but overspend ourselves for a good period of time.
Well, we were spending too much. Asian nations were saving too much. That made money cheap all over the world. Central banks were trying to prevent really bad outcomes in the last downturn in 2001-2002. So there were a lot of things going on to lead to this situation, and yes, Americans have been the beneficiaries. We've bought houses we couldn't afford. We've spent more money than we made, but the truth is it's unwinding now.
Okay, thank you so much, Neil Irwin. I know you have to go, but we'll be back in just a couple of seconds with more on The Economy.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the California Endowment, working to improve the health and healthcare of California's diverse communities. At the California Endowment, community matters.
Programming is supported by Warner Independent Pictures, presenting Snow Angels, written for the screen and directed by David Gordon Green, a heartrending portrayal of the innocence and tragedy of love, starring Kate Beckinsale and Sam Rockwell. Opens today at the Arclight and Landmark.
This is 89.3 KPCC Traffic and Weather at kpcc.org. Michigan Democrats are said to be close to an agreement with the party's two presidential candidates on holding a do-over primary. Party officials met with representatives of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama yesterday. The clock is ticking. A vote would have to be held by June 10th. Good news and not so good news when it comes to the economy. Consumer prices have posted their mildest reading in 6 months. The Labor Department says inflation held steady last month thanks to a temporary fall in energy and food. The relief, however, isn't expected to last long because energy prices have resumed their upward climb. Here in L.A., meanwhile, Mayor Villaraigosa is asking department heads to come up with ideas to solve the city's budget deficit after his call for employees to take unpaid vacation days yielded a paltry $95,000 in savings. Villaraigosa had hoped for $20 million. It's 10:21.
Do you have an old car, truck, or boat taking up space in your garage? Give it to KPCC. Donating your used vehicle goes a long way toward paying for the news and information you count on each day. It takes just a couple of minutes to schedule a pickup, and we'll send you a receipt for your income taxes. Find out more online at kpcc.org or call 877-KPCC-CAR. Thanks.
This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. I'm Ted Chen from NBC4, KNBC, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle this morning. We continue our discussion of the state of the U.S. economy and the announcement this morning that the nation's fifth largest investment bank, Bear Stearns, is getting a big assist, what many would call a bailout, from the federal government and from J.P. Morgan Chase, the nation's third largest bank. This as Bear Stearns racked up nearly $3 billion in losses since last year, and the stock lost half its value within the first 30 minutes of the opening of the stock market today. And also the president today, President Bush, tried to reassure investors and the country that even though we are going through what he called obviously a tough time, the president expressed confidence about an economic rebound. We continue our discussion with Rex Nutting, D.C. Bureau Chief of MarketWatch.com. And Rex, I want to go over kind of an interesting quote, I thought, from the chief executive of Bear Stearns, who initially had denied that the company was having cash flow problems, and essentially said that because of those rumors that he had denied initially that they found themselves in a liquidity problem, which I found very interesting. I mean, how plausible is that?
Well, I think it can be very plausible. You know, these things can be self-fulfilling prophecies. Once one person believes that the bank won't pay off, then you run to get your assets out. You run to cash in as fast as you can, and that's what a run on the bank really is. If everybody would have confidence in the bank, then everybody would be eventually get paid. But they get squeezed when everybody rushes in at the same time, and that's likely what happened to Bear Stearns. I mean, it was no secret there were rumors all over, all week, that they were having their liquidity squeezed, that they were running short of cash, and so, you know, nobody wants to be the last one in, and that's what happens in a situation like this. And that's really why we have institutions like the Fed or the FDIC in the case of retail banks to come in and say, you know, we'll back you up, we'll guarantee so that investors and depositors can have some confidence that they'll get their money back.
Are you saying, though, that if these rumors hadn't started earlier this week, that we may not be in the situation we are now, that where Bear Stearns needed a bailout?
Well, it's quite possible, but we don't really know what the true condition of their balance sheet is. We don't know the inside of what's happening in that bank, but it's possible that it's just a run on the bank that's created by rumors. But, of course, we know that they're in fragile condition because of the condition of what's on their balance sheet. They're very extended. They're what they call leveraged. You know, each dollar of assets they have has been lent out 33 times. So even a small drop in the value of those assets can wipe out their value. And I think a lot of people are fearful that that's what's happened to Bear Stearns. You know, most people really don't expect Bear Stearns to survive this, that somebody will come in and buy the best of their assets, and the rest of the things will have to just be written off. There'll be a complete loss. And, you know, life will go on without Bear Stearns.
What makes J.P. Morgan Chase, what puts them in a healthier position right now where they can help out Bear Stearns, and what can we learn from that?
Well, J.P. Morgan didn't really participate in a lot of the worst of the frenzy on Wall Street to write these very, very exotic mortgage-backed securities that were highly leveraged. And that was really Bear Stearns. That's where they were making their money. But J.P. Morgan has a more diverse business than Bear Stearns did. And they just didn't participate into the same extent that some of these other investment banks did. Now, J.P. Morgan also has a regular bank, Chase, and that's the sort of the conduit through which the Bear Stearns was able to get money from the Fed, was through the J.P. Morgan's bank, which does have a relationship with the Federal Reserve. So they have a bigger business, I guess, and it's a healthier business.
Well, you know, I mean, as investors, we're always told it's better to diversify, and that's a smart thing to do. And so when you hear about a situation like this where it sounds like J.P. Morgan Chase was a better diversified company and Bear Stearns was not, is this something that just Wall Street was generally aware of, and how does that permit itself, for lack of a better term, in this market?
Well, I think that you know, people were aware of what their strategy was, and during the times, you know, it's nice to be diversified when things are going poorly, but that seems like a foolish thing to do when there's one investment that you could make that's making you 30, 40, 50% a year. There's a great incentive to try to put all of your eggs in that basket and maximize your returns, and it takes a really disciplined person to say, I'm going to forego some profits, I'm going to be a little bit safer in my investments than somebody else who's just trying to get the most they can today, you know. And I think a lot of people, you know, were lulled by the easy returns they were getting from some of these things. And of course, even everyday homeowners were lulled into complacency by this, thinking that the value in their home would always go up, that they could make 10% a year without doing anything. And people were taking cash out of their homes, and people were refinancing their homes and building on more debt, thinking, well, my home will never fall in value. And so, you know, really, Bear didn't do anything that a lot of, you know, maybe millions of people haven't done. They just did it at a bigger scale.
Are we going to see this keep happening to other banks? And what's the reason for optimism here? What could be the light at the end of the tunnel that maybe people can see, a sign that people can see that a corner has been turned?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that anybody can say that this is the bottom. I think that it's going to take time. We're going to have to see. You know, people are going to have to actually come clean with what they've invested in, what's on their balance sheet over time, and eventually all the dirt will come out, and we'll sort of have a better picture. But I think right now it's just way too early to think that this is the bottom. It might be. This might be the only big failure, or the only bank that needs to go to hell, to the Fed for help, but we can't be sure of that. There's just too much uncertainty about what's out there, and I think that's the real root cause of the liquidity crisis we have, is that nobody trusts anybody that they're doing business with right now. It doesn't matter how stellar your reputation is. You just aren't trusted out there in the marketplace, so people are pulling back and trying to preserve their capital, and that's the root cause.
And last question, I mean, we've talked about the risks of a collapse of Bear Stearns, and that's why this is taking place. What's the risk or the potential risks by the Federal Reserve doing this, by J.P. Morgan Chase taking part in this? Isn't there a cost on that end as well?
Well, the Fed has sort of guaranteed J.P. Morgan won't be at risk for any of this. It's really a transaction between Bear Stearns and the Federal Reserve, and the Fed has said, give us your very best collateral, the mortgages that you know will be paid off, the asset-backed paper that you know is good. We'll take that, and we'll leave you with all the really shady stuff. But we'll give you some cash, and you can see if you can make it through the weekend. We'll see if you can make it through next week. We'll see if you can raise some more capital from the private world. And if they can, great. The Fed gets paid back. If Bear were to fail it or not pay back those loans, the Fed would take on that collateral. They would own it. But hopefully, the Fed has been tough, and they've said we'll only take the very best stuff. And the Fed could then turn around and sell that, maybe not next week, but eventually the Fed would get its money back. That's been the history of most of these bailouts, is that actually the federal institution that provided the money actually makes money on this. There actually is a profit to be made in being the backstop.
Okay, thank you so much. Rex Nutting, D.C. Bureau Chief of MarketWatch.com. Coming up, we'll talk to Fred Krupp, the president of the Environmental Defense Fund and the author of a new book, Earth, the Sequel.
Commercial radio is paid for with commercials. Public radio is paid for by the public. That would be you. Public radio thrives only when listeners like you decide to become contributing members. Those individual contributions are the largest source of the money it takes to pay for the high-quality news you hear every day. Become a member now. It takes just a minute or two at kpcc.org. Thanks.
This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. I'm Ted Chen from NBC4, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle. In his new book, Earth, the Sequel, Fred Krupp insists we can solve global warming. The president of the Environmental Defense Fund says that in doing so, we will build new industries, jobs, and fortunes of the 21st century. And Fred Krupp, the president of the Environmental Defense Fund, joins us in studio. Fred, thanks for coming in.
Oh, Ted, thanks. It's my delight.
You are a co-author with Miriam Horn of this book, which just came out this week, Earth, the Sequel, The Race to Reinvent Energy and Stop Global Warming. First, tell me about the title. Why is it Earth, the Sequel?
Well, you know, we all know the story of Earth now, which is sadly melting glaciers, rising sea levels, dying coral reefs, strengthening hurricanes. The stakes are very grave, but what interests me is what's next? How do we get out of this slow-motion horror movie that we've all been living in? And I've come to understand that what's next is going to be an adventure movie where we the hero wins. We solve the problem, and we will be the hero. Engineers and entrepreneurs will be the hero. So I had a glimpse of this future a year and a half ago while watching some engineers talk about what they're working on, and decided to share that glimpse with everyone else.
Not a bad way to promote this book in Los Angeles by couching it in Hollywood terms, by the way. One of the interesting things I read in the LA Times review, kind of the question just kind of thrown out there, why should technology and the market, which you believe in strongly, be counted on to solve this crisis when those two things are the ones that got us into this crisis of global warming to begin with? Why don't you address that?
Yeah, well, there's no question the profit motive got us into this fix. So it does sound a little counterintuitive that here as an environmentalist, I believe that profit and innovation can get us out of this fix. But here's why. You know, first of all, we're definitely going to need government to do what government needs to do, and the book makes that argument quite clearly. Because if we allowed, for instance, garbage trucks to drive up to the local park and dump their garbage, unfortunately some would. And in this country, in the United States of America, we're now the last industrialized country in the whole world that allows anyone, any business, to just dump global warming gases, global warming pollution into the atmosphere. So the first thing that needs to happen is for the government to impose a mandatory limit, a legal limit or a cap on the amount of global warming that can be thrown into the atmosphere, and then decline that cap, keep ratcheting down on what's allowed. So Ted, it's only once government does what it needs to do that then it starts this race. What I've come to think of as the greatest and most important race of our time, indeed of any time, because it really is a race against time. But once government does that, it changes the economics. The economists would tell us it internalizes the externalities. It forces people to pay if they want to dump air pollution into the sky. And it sets up a credit system where if an entrepreneur can figure out how to take this pollution out of a smokestack or out of the air even, they earn a credit that can be sold for money. So we harness the business folks. We harness the entrepreneurs to work for what we need for the planet to thrive.
You are a big believer in the free market system. I get that sense when you read this book and also the history of your activism. But you do believe that it needs to start with government. The government can get out of the way, but at the very top of this equation, if you will, it needs to start with setting a cost which is not built into the economic fabric and is not acknowledged, the cost of industries that do pollute, the cost of the pollution itself.
That's exactly right. I would say it a little bit differently, Ted. I think the government needs to set this cap, which the cap gives us a guarantee that pollution will go down. Nowhere in the world have we solved an air pollution problem without government saying, that's it. That's the limit. So the government has to set the cap, and then the cap does, as just as you've said, translate into a cost. So it's not a libertarian view. It's not really even a free market view, but it is a market view in that once the government does this one thing, we then give people freedom and businesses freedom to pick how they're going to do it. So we don't have government picking winners and losers. Because what I've come to see in my 23 years working for the Environmental Defense Fund, EDF, is that when we have government picking winners and losers, who wins? Whoever hires the best lobbyists. Who loses? All the rest of us. Because the government makes bad decisions. It costs us all more money. So the role for government is to set standards and then let these entrepreneurs that we talk about in the book let them loose.
But a fundamental challenge seems to be getting industries and people in general to think of polluting as an economic cost, because
yes.
We always hear the other side, well, all these measures to address global warming are going to cost so much. And the pollution itself has an environmental cost but doesn't have an economic cost. How do we fundamentally begin to change that thinking?
Well, it has to be through a law that actually imposes a cap and that right now, if you can burn coal and just put the pollution in the sky and you don't have to clean up, there's no cost. But once you do have to clean up, there is a cost, and that's what changes the fundamental.
The problem
economics.
Is, though, industry sees that as a government-imposed cost and not a quote-unquote natural cost.
Ah, yes. You're right. But it is a natural cost, and now people are demanding that the government take action. And the good news is all three presidential candidates, Obama, Clinton, and McCain, have all said they are going to do exactly what we're advocating. They're going to impose a legal limit or a cap. They're going to bring the United States up to the standards of the rest of the developed world. And so this will happen. I would say right now we have a 90% chance in the next 18 to 24 months of getting a global warming bill through Congress that will start this great transformation of the whole economy, and particularly the energy economy, which is a $6 trillion business. So there's going to be enormous fortunes made by guys like Bernie Carl. He's in Alaska, has this resort 60 miles northwest of Fairbanks.
I want you to continue that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment to talk more about this huge enterprise, and we're talking with Fred Krupp. He's the author of Earth, the Sequel, and we welcome your phone calls, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC.
This week, KPCC reports on prison inmates who return home to Southern California. Help is hard to come by. Many find it at Christian halfway houses.
I have brothers here, and people have been through what I've been through, and they've got the Lord in their life today, and they're changing. And I see a true happiness, and it's something that I want.
Today on All Things Considered, an examination of how faith helps some people end their lives of crime. Only on 89.3 KPCC. For more on this series, go to kpcc.org.
We have a giveaway for you right now on KPCC. It's for a pair of tickets to see Culture Clash in America and the South Coast Repertory March 16th through April 6th. The Latino Comedy Troupe presents city-specific shows ranging from San Francisco and the Big Apple to Little Cuba. Now they've added Orange County to the mix. Their explosion of ideas bursts forth in every direction with scenes that are political, social, satirical, ethnic, fearless, and hysterical. Variety is called Culture Clash Comic Masters. Tickets available at scr.org. We'll take the third caller at 626-585-7266. 7893. The LA City Council's Ad Hoc Committee on Gang Violence and Youth Development will hold a hearing this afternoon on an audit calling for consolidating LA's anti-gang programs in the mayor's office and redirecting $19 million in funding. City Controller Laura Chick's office performed the audit. She's expected to testify before the committee, along with City Attorney Rocky Delgadillo and LA County Sheriff Lee Baca. Southland law enforcement officers will be out in force starting today to combat drunk driving over the St. Patrick's Day weekend. Last year, 16 people were killed statewide in traffic collisions over the weekend, and 304 were injured. At the same time, 1,250 motorists were arrested for DUI. It's going to be mostly sunny today with highs near 70. It's 10:41.
Good morning, and welcome back to Air Talk. This is Ted Chen from NBC4, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a great Friday. We continue our discussion with Fred Krupp. He is the author of Earth, the Sequel, and also the president of the Environmental Defense Fund. And before we continue, Fred, I want to give out our phone number again for people to ask questions because there are so many wonderful technologies explored in this book, and then I'm sure people will have a lot of questions about them. 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. And I want to continue. You were talking about one of the many innovators that are profiled in your book, and one of the things that struck me is how much is out there in terms of renewable and sustainable energy.
There are an abundance of alternatives, and that's one of the things that gives me hope that we can and we will solve this global warming challenge. But the innovator I was talking about was Bernie Carl. He's an Alaskan. He bought this resort. He was spending $1,000 a day to burn diesel fuel to generate electricity. And he decided in the pursuit of profit that to get a lot more people coming up to Alaska to his resort, he was going to build a hotel made out of ice and only ice. So he built the hotel, and he wanted to keep it frozen all year. Unfortunately, summer came, and it melted, and his $20,000 investment melted too.
Could he not have foreseen that?
Well, he built a cooling system, but it wasn't quite up to the standards. Anyway, Forbes magazine had caught their attention. In fact, they dubbed it the dumbest business idea of the year. And but, you know, he's an American entrepreneur. He had this vision. He knew he could get people to come there if he could build this ice hotel. So he rebuilt it. This time he worked with an engineer named Gwen, who had run the Iditarod, a dog sledder. And they figured out the cooling system. The hotel stays frozen all year round now. People are lining up to get in. He went one step further. He decided he was going to generate all his electricity with geothermal energy, and that's the energy they used for the hotel too. And he became the first person anywhere in the world to use low temperature, just warm water instead of hot water, to generate electricity. So it's not only about Bernie. He's making a bunch of money. He's got this clean energy with no greenhouse gas emissions. But he teamed up with United Technologies to do it. They've started a whole new division, Ted. They're now selling hundreds of these things all over the world. So these are the sorts of entrepreneurs we talk about in Earth, the Sequel. And these are the entrepreneurs that, you know, even though I'm an environmental lawyer, I've come to believe, yes, government has an important role to play to start this race. But ultimately, the government role is a supporting role. The starring role belongs to the engineers and the entrepreneurs.
And in the book, you go over the pluses and minuses of each technology. I mean, you talk about geothermal, you talk about solar energy and solar thermal and biofuels. Do you have a particular favorite that you think is going to lead the way or kind of make the big splash? Or I mean, I know in a lot of ways you see a combination of all of them too, but who do you favor?
Well, I don't think any one technology is going to get us out of the fix we're in. We need this whole bouquet of alternatives, and that's why I was so happy spending a year and a half researching and writing this book to find out there are so many alternatives. I would say that, you know, we started the book off with two chapters on solar energy because there's so much sunlight. Mm-hmm. It would take 0.1% of the sun's energy that reaches the Earth. If we could just convert that much, we could power the whole world. So, in fact, we could power the United States if we just had a block of land 100 miles aside. If imagine a square of land that's 100 miles on each side. That in the desert would be enough to generate all the electricity for the United States. So we have a chapter on solar thermal energy, and the folks at ASRA, the company was started in Australia, in a garage. They built this equipment. They miscalculated a little bit, so they had trouble getting it out of the garage. But ultimately, they've now signed contracts with PG&E and other major utilities to take this idea to scale. And the wonderful thing about solar thermal is storing the energy as hot water is as easy as putting it in a thermos bottle. It's not as complicated as batteries. But we have a chapter on photovoltaics, and we talk about innovators up in Silicon Valley like Conrad Burke. Conrad is the first person to figure out, instead of using the purified silicon that computer chips are made out of, and there's in short supply and it's expensive, he basically has taken sand, the unpurified silicon, the cheap stuff, and he's figured out how to liquefy it into a paint. And he basically can paint solar cells onto just about anything. Well, one of the problems with solar cells so far is they're not used by all of us because the price has still been a little bit too high. Well, instead of now having to buy a solar array panel with a glass box and you put it on top of your roof, Conrad Burke and his company in Novalight is painting the solar cells onto thin metal foil, and that becomes the roof.
And the book is chock full of stories like these. And one of the let's actually give out our phone number again before we continue. 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. If you have questions for Fred Krupp, who is the co-author with Miriam Horm of Earth, the Sequel, The Race to Reinvent Energy and Stop Global Warming. With regards to solar energy, you do talk about the problems that exist with storage and trying to solve that and cost, whereas biofuels, which you also devote a couple of chapters to, we already have much more of an infrastructure. So I'm wondering, can both proceed, or do we take advantage of what we have right now as far as biofuels and our progress there, and because the costs are potentially lower there at the expense of solar energy, or can both move ahead feasibly forward?
Oh, they both can move ahead. The beauty of having the government do what it needs to do to start the race, firing the starting gun, if you will, is that once you impose this limit on how much pollution you can dump into the sky, then all these alternatives can flower. But biofuels, boy, there's fascinating things going on there. We all know about the conventional ethanol that's made from just the sugar in the kernel of the corn, and there's problems with that. It turns out that that is not such a great solution. It causes the price of food to go up, and it's not. It's very unclear that it makes a significant contribution, if any, to reducing global warming pollution.
And it takes a lot of energy to make it.
So there's new forms of biofuels that this company Amyris has come up with. And what they figured out how to do is forget about making ethanol, which doesn't mix with water and you need separate infrastructure for that. They are actually figured out how to make gasoline and jet fuel out of the sugar. And they're doing it by reprogramming yeast, bioengineering and software programming. They trick the yeast into making these fuels. So these guys are biochemists. They've already figured out how to synthesize the cure for malaria. And they've licensed it to a company on a condition that the company has to provide it to Africa for free. And they will end up saving, based on what they've already done, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, $200 million a year.
And are they the ones that also convert carbs, essentially, like the husk of sugar canes into fuel as well, which I thought was interesting because it's essentially what athletes do, you know, converting carbs to energy, and that these companies are doing that as well.
Yeah, no, actually, that's Verinium, I think you're thinking of in the book.
I'm getting the companies mixed. You profile so many in the book.
We do. Verinium is a company that's figured out how to convert just the leftover plant material, the fiber, into sugars. And they are a fascinating company. They've merged with Diversa, which has a lab down in San Diego. These guys in San Diego have gone out all over the world searching for extremophiles. What is an extremophile? It's an organism that can exist in places where nothing else can live. Toxic volcanoes, hot volcanoes, and toxic environments. The bottom of the ocean, deep sea vents, and they look for organisms that eat things that nothing else can eat, because then they take the enzymes from these organisms and figure out if they can help us eat waste plants, garbage, wood chips, and it's quite an interesting company. They then put all of these woody materials into a big vat and digest them kind of like a beer maker. In fact, they've hired the head brewmaster from Anheuser-Busch to run their new facility in Louisiana.
All the different energies that you talk about, from biofuels to the electricity produced by renewable sources, how widely available is it to your average consumer? Because it does strike me that it's still limited in terms of where you can actually get it, that the average person may not be able to, I mean, especially with regard to biofuels, I mean, pretty much are still pretty limited there and as far as the access to electricity too.
Yes, it is very limited today. There's not enough money going into this, even though there's been a lot more money going in, $4 billion in the last year by some accounts, into clean energy. It's much less than is needed. And but we have the resource. Here in the West, we're close to the desert, which has an enormous amount of sunlight, one of the best areas in the whole world to collect solar energy. Further north, there's tremendous wave energy. We talk about the conversion of waves and even tides to energy. So the resource is available. What's needed is for the government to put into effect a law that requires us to stop dumping the pollution. And then there's a cascade of money that goes to these entrepreneurs. There's great wealth, new fortunes created, new jobs for Americans, and these technologies then come on stream. And then they're widely available to consumers.
Let's take a phone call. Imad in Encino, welcome to Air Talk. You're on with Fred Krupp.
Thank you for taking the call. Your speaker just mentioned governments, and my question was exactly, as I see, entrepreneurs are essential to creating or inventing new technologies, but we also need laws that support them. And to take, for example, the city of Las Vegas, for Pete's sake, it's rich in sunlight, and none of the hotels have really done or converted to solar energy, which they can utilize. And as they did in a city in China where the government made it essential to do so. What can we do to make these politicians get on board and make things happen of this sort?
What a powerful symbol would be if a giant Las Vegas hotel was utilizing solar energy.
That is a great question, and I completely agree with the caller. And I've been trying to make the point that this is really very much dependent on government taking action. And what we need to do as citizens is demand that the government do take action. The fact that now the three presidential candidates have called for this steeply declining cap on global warming pollution is the best and biggest action that could be taken nationwide. I mean, in California, we have AB 32, the global warming law that is going to go into effect and will bring on more solar energy. But nationwide, the current bill pending in the Senate is called the Lieberman-Warner bill, and that will be the biggest thing that could happen to get solar energy going in all the places in America, such as Las Vegas, and really bring it about.
Well, you're a big advocate of carbon caps, and there's a significant debate in AB 32, which you just mentioned, is about a cap on carbon emissions. But there still is a debate about carbon caps versus taxes on carbon emissions, with some economists believing that if you have if you focus on taxes, that it's more defined, and they worry that a carbon cap would result in a manipulation by the businesses. So kind of make the argument, if you can, why carbon caps are better than carbon taxes.
Sure. It turns out that nowhere in the world have we solved a problem, an air pollution problem, which this is, without having a cap or a legal limit. And so the carbon cap and trade system gives you that legal limit that companies really are not allowed to dump their pollution into the sky. Exxon would not be allowed to sell gasoline above a certain amount because of the pollution that would be associated with burning it unless they lowered the carbon content of their fuel or purchased a actual verified scientific reduction of emissions somewhere else to get under the cap that was assigned to them. A tax is just allow someone to pay potentially a small fee to continue polluting and doesn't give you the guarantee that the pollution is going to come down. That is why the environmental community in the United States is very much for having a legal limit or a cap.
So you don't believe raising taxes on carbon emissions and thereby, you know, increasing the costs of using fossil fuels would result in a significant decrease?
Well, we don't know
or
how
enough of one.
We don't know how much of a decrease, and we don't know how much of a tax you'd have to increase, and we don't know what would happen to the tax revenues. When you have a cap, you also raise the price because you force the folks that burn coal to clean up the coal emissions, clean up the carbon dioxide coming from coal. So you get the same effect of raising the price, but you know it will go up enough to get the job done, because if it doesn't, the companies can go to jail because they're polluting more than their limit. So the key to the cap is not to cap at current levels, to cap at reduced levels and keep that legal mandate going down, down, down.
Last question, because we're running out of time. One of the fundamental points you make is that the deck in terms of government policy is so stacked in favor of the fossil fuel industry, and alternative energy just needs a level playing field.
Yes.
So how do we achieve that?
Well, it's important that we increase the amount of research dollars going from the federal government for these technologies. In the last year, it was about $1 billion. So that compares to Exxon's sales in a day of $1 billion. So there's far too little money going to this. But again, the biggest way you level the playing field is right now the biggest subsidy that we give to these fossil fuel companies is we allow them to use our air as a dumping ground. Once we stop that...
And we subsidize that.
We subsidize that, right? Once we stop that, that's the biggest way we can level the playing field.
Thank you so much. The book is Earth, the Sequel, The Race to Reinvent Energy and Stop Global Warming. It is from Norton, and it is out in bookstores. Fred Krupp is the co-author with Miriam Horm, and Fred is also the president of the Environmental Defense Fund. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ted.
Coming up, we'll talk about the... ESPN documentary, the new one called Black Magic, talking about basketball players and coaches in historical black colleges and universities.